This is Steve Maxer conducting an interview with Mr. Steve Sumrall on the 26th of August, 2002, at approximately 9:15 Lubbock time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Steve Sumrall is in Renton, Washington. Sir, why don't we begin today's interview with a brief discussion of your early life, if you would tell me when and where you were born and where you grew up.
Okay, I was born November 18, 1945, in San Diego, California. But I was raised and lived almost all of my life in Riverside, California. Mm-hmm. What's your next question?
Sure. Well, what was it like growing up in Riverside?
Oh, in Riverside? I was raised by a single-parent mother, my half-brother and I, and a sister, and raised by a single parent with not too much education. I was raised on the kind of a poor side of town. But my mom was very conscientious and did a good job as a parent and mm-hmm. as best she could under the circumstances. And I was educated in the school system there and was had a very conservative background. My mom saw that I attended church regularly, and I grew up in the school system, participated in a lot of extracurricular activities and sports programs, Little League Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in a city, but it was backed up to a rural area. Spent a lot of time as a young man, kind of independent with friends and fishing and hiking and doing a lot of things that young people do.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of school, what were your favorite subjects? What did you like to study, if anything?
Well, I grew up, I don't know, I struggled in my earlier years in school and did not excel, but because of my situation with a single parent, I don't know, early on I was looking for, realizing that I would have to be independent and take care of myself, and I remember in the seventh grade going to the library and looking up careers. And that year I had taken drafting. That's the year that they give you a third of a year in metal shop, a third of a year in wood shop, and drafting a third of the year. And I excelled in drafting with straight A's. So then I went to the library and looked up careers and looked up engineering and architecture and decided, hey, there's something I can excel in. And so after that time I started taking all the elective classes for drafting and architecture, and eventually graduated high school with taking drafting for 4 years and architecture for 2 years, and eventually went into my first year of college as an architecture major.
Now, was that with the intent of what kind of construction, what kind of architecture in particular? Did you have any idea?
It was commercial and residential architecture.
Okay.
was my goal, mm-hmm. but at the same time, as I got into college, I had a number of professors. One of them was an architect, and after some dialogue with him, I was growing up in church and very conservative. He was talking about a successful architect spends much of his time away from home at cocktail parties, drumming up business for the architectural firm, and I kind of at that time realized maybe that wasn't exactly what I wanted,
mm-hmm.
and so then I kind of shifted more into mechanical engineering courses.
Okay.
And that was about the time that I took a summer off to work from college, and then I got notification in the mail that because I wasn't in college during the summer, I was subject to the draft.
Okay. Now, what did you, as you were growing up in the 1950s,
mm-hmm.
what do you remember about Cold War events, in particular things like, in 1949, the fall of, you would have been extremely young at that point, but the fall of China, to communism in 1950s, the Korean War, were these things in your perspective at all?
I do remember in junior high school, I remember the Kennedy years when we went nose-to-nose with Russia,
mm-hmm.
and the nuclear missile crisis in Cuba. And I remember going with my mother over to San Bernardino and actually looking to purchase a bomb shelter.
Mm.
And so things were very nervous. It was a very nervous time for the population at that time.
Right.
And although we didn't buy one because of the expense, it was a nervous time. But I do remember that as far as living under the threat of nuclear holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And even in school, going through the drills and that sort of thing.
What were those like, the drills that you had to do?
It was films, you know, about what an explosion could be anticipated and what to look for, and bright lights, and if you see that, what to do to, mm-hmm. you know, duck and go under your desk,
mm-hmm.
and as if that was really going to protect you. But, you know, they went through the motions of trying to be aware, and I do remember, like in downtown Riverside, seeing signs for civil defense and
mm-hmm.
Air raid shelters.
Mm-hmm.
So the city had done some preparation to, if there was a nuclear exchange, to have some places for people to go down. Although in Southern California, there aren't a lot of basements.
Mm-hmm.
But I think any that there were, they did convert them into some sort of shelter.
Okay. Now, was that, those films, do you remember, did that have Bert the Turtle or someone like that in them? The Duck and Cover Turtle?
I don't remember that.
Okay.
But I do.
Yeah. Just the drill itself.
Yeah.
Now, how about other major events before you went to Vietnam, in particular in Southeast Asia? For instance, the Gulf of Tonkin incidents and the resolutions and the buildup of American forces. How much was that discussed? I guess would have been near the end of your high school or early college.
Yes, it was, and I do remember. Early on hearing about the escalation of advisors in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I remember issues about the presidency of Vietnam being changed. I remember there was a coup d'etat, and
mm-hmm.
Was it Diem who
yes.
was
mm-hmm.
killed?
Mm-hmm.
And there was some underlying suspicions about different factions involved and even maybe the government of, you know, the CIA or something being... Although not a lot of detail came out at that time, but there was some, like how the government was sponsoring certain organizations of the government in South Vietnam and not others, and so there was some dialogue about just, you know, who was the cause of the coup and that sort of thing. But the main thing I remember was my neighborhood. At that time, there was a young man that I grew up with who had gone into the Army early, right out of high school. And when I was going to my first year in college, I found out that he had gone over in the infantry and had stepped on a landmine and was killed. And I had walked down the street about four or five houses to his grandmother who raised him and had met with her about that. And she was devastated, of course. But I remember going down and trying to console her and let her know my feelings, you know, because he was a kid that I had grew up with and played with, and that was my first real contact with a casualty of war over there in Vietnam, and it seemed so far away, and I didn't even realize that he'd gone on active duty until I found out he'd been killed. So that was my first
mm-hmm.
experience locally
mm-hmm.
with anybody that was directly involved with Vietnam, other than hearing news reports about the troop buildup.
Did you watch the news very much?
Quite often, but, you know, in high school, that was the year when I was starting to date and
mm-hmm.
be involved socially, and my mom, of course, would keep me appraised of the latest news coming from Vietnam.
Right. What about the Kennedy assassination?
That was devastating to me.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, my mother was a Democrat. I was more, because of my church background, seemed to be leaning at that time more Republican.
Mm-hmm.
But all of us, my mother, myself, and all people at school and my associates at church, really respected President Kennedy, and he was so dynamic as a speaker, and all the young people seemed to really be attached to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that happened, it was November 22nd. I remember I was planning to go on a date that night with my best friend and his girlfriend and my new girlfriend. And it happened at school. I was in architecture class, and there was some news bulletin as I was leaving architecture going to chemistry, mm-hmm. and by the time I reached chemistry, it was confirmed that he had been shot and was at the hospital, and then sometime later in that class, I think, we got the word that he, you know, they confirmed that he was killed. Mm-hmm. And it was, I mean, the whole class, all of us put our heads down on the desk, and it was just horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember getting home after school and calling and my friends and confirming, thinking that we were going to call off our date, but we actually did go, and it was very melancholy get together that evening. And because all of us, even though my girlfriend was a Republican and not a you know, not a particularly enamored with Kennedy because of her parents were Republicans, and but we all, even she, was devastated by his death. And to think that it could happen in this country, that he could be killed, and then followed so closely, with the broadcasts on a daily basis after that, and then most of us realized that there was something involved other than a single assassin. And I think everybody, even though the government tried to say it wasn't a coup d'etat or that it was a single wild crazy man, there was too many. And my mother and I actually saw the live broadcast of the filming of the smoke coming from the knoll, and heard some immediate interviews from people saying, yeah, the shot came right across their shoulder. So we realized that the government was saying there was one shot from the suppository, but the book suppository.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we saw a motorcycle policeman take his motorcycle up the hill towards the smoke and saw the smoke on the hill. And so we were all, we knew better. And yet to this day, we're told that it was not a coup d'etat. And yet, you know, mm-hmm. I know it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the government was involved in some way, some aspects of the government,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, what about then the I'm sorry, go ahead.
The effect to us was an immediate disillusionment with government and news media and what we were being told and propaganda and all that sort of thing. So I think it was an eye-opening for a lot of people in this country.
Mm-hmm. Was that something that you talked much about with your friends?
Yes. I think we talked quite a bit about it.
Okay. And what about, you know, very close to the assassination, of course, then Lee Harvey Oswald was killed. What did that, what effect did that have on you guys? And did you yourself witness that?
Yes, I actually saw it on television live, yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I did. And to me, it was just another aspect of a complication of a cover-up.
Uh-huh.
In my opinion.
Okay.
It was... Yeah, I don't know how to go into too much detail. I mean, mm-hmm. I could talk for hours just about all of the movies that have been made over the years,
mm-hmm.
You know, but it was... it was a time realizing that, you know, things weren't just all that rosy,
mm-hmm.
as far as our lives here in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And that this country and politics was as shaky and unstable as many other countries.
Well, how were... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No.
I was just going to ask you how race relations were around where you grew up. And what were the
ethnic... race relations... Now, when I grew up in a high school that I think... I'm trying to remember exactly. It was about... less than 1,000 students, I think. And I think my graduating class was like... 500 or so, and out of that 500, I was probably 80% Caucasian, and you know, or 75% Caucasian, and maybe 10% Latino, and 15 or 20% Black. And there wasn't any segregation, and of course in California, but I think there was a little bit of tension, and sometimes there was some fist fights. And some of that thing. And I remember one incident personally that happened to me is walking from lunch up to a class and walking up a hallway and being confronted by maybe 30 or 40 black people. And as I'm walking through, one of them stepped in front of me and pulled a switchblade and pointed it at my stomach and made a comment about wanting to see the insides, my insides. And I kind of shuddered and said, well, I don't have time to talk. The bell just rang and I'm late for class. And I kind of just brushed him aside and kept walking. And so that was a negative experience with a black person. But then I'd had positive experience with black people. So I know it was just my, as far as my personal relationship with, I don't think I was ever had any problems with, you know, what's the term? My mind just went blank. But
you mean problems with racism or?
Racism, yeah. Although I think my mother was a little racist, I don't think I was because of the way I grew up at school.
Mm.
And my mother had some opinions, but and I don't think it rubbed off on me too much.
Was that the only run-in you had with that particular person?
That's probably the only time I ever met him in my life personally.
Huh. And he didn't say a thing. You just didn't have to go to class and he'll let you go by.
Yeah. That was, okay. You know, but it was, you know, right. I've never had a knife to the since or before ever pulled on me in my life. So it was a momentous thing. And
oh, absolutely. It seems like you handled it in the right way.
Yeah, I just kind of brushed it off. I didn't know what else to do. I certainly wasn't going to fight him. I was not a physical guy back then. I was not a bully or a provocator or anything like that. I was a pretty benign sort of a guy, so I would be one of the last ones to be involved in an altercation like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, but you did mention that you played some sports, baseball in particular. Did you play anything else? Any other sports that you liked?
Oh, I play, in junior high school? I know one thing. In grammar school, you know how kids, it's more important whose buddy is whose buddy, and you get picked on a team by whose friend you are. Later on in junior high school, you start to get more competitive, and teams are organized by who can play best. And because I was very good at baseball and stuff, I started getting picked not because I was a friend of somebody, but because I was capable. And so I felt good about sports and being successful and playing baseball and basketball. Although I wasn't a varsity sports player, I did play church basketball and baseball, and I think I excelled quite well.
Okay.
But when it came to high school sports, my architecture instructor was also the track coach and cross country coach, and he kind of conned me into joining the cross country team, which I never thought I'd ever be a runner, but
mm-hmm.
I got a varsity letter in cross country. I ran cross country 2 years,
okay. And
then I also played varsity tennis. So I wasn't what you'd call a jock in high school, but I did get a varsity letter and enjoyed sports. That's about the extent of it.
Okay. Let's see. Now, get back to politics in Vietnam real quick. You mentioned that the effect that the assassination of JFK had on you and some of the people, some of your friends, in terms of your disillusionment or your cynicism.
Yes.
What were you thinking, what were you talking about with friends as the Vietnam War was unfolding and was becoming much more... something that more than likely you would have to become involved in through the draft or through voluntary military service?
Personally, the way I felt about America, and I'd grown up my life in America, and I was patriotic, and I, even though through the assassination I didn't picture that as a reason not to be patriotic to the country, and so when they started drafting and needing men for the military. My background is that my father had been in the Navy during the Second World War, and I'd had relatives in my family, members of the military, and of course I was always as a young man watching lots of John Wayne movies, and so to me, military service would be something that I would probably go into and not shy away from.
Mm-hmm.
but there was some controversy in school, and there was a little bit as early as 66 about, protesting against the war and our involvement over there. Mm-hmm. And some of the associations I had in either college or at church, there was some discussion about, gee, if I'm called, will I go? And some were saying, heck, hell no, I'll do anything. I'll leave the country if I have to. It was a couple comments by a couple of men, fellows that I knew, and I was a little shocked that they would take that position, because my position was that, hey, I've lived here all my life, and I'm an American, and if I get drafted, that's my duty, mm-hmm. that I would make the decision to go.
Okay.
And that was, there were dialogues along those lines at that time, mm-hmm. in that year.
Mm-hmm. In 1966, while you were in college?
Yes.
Now, in terms of military service and your background, in your family background, did you have very much contact with your grandparents on your mother's side?
Yes, I was real close to my grandparents on my mother's side.
And did your grandfather have military service as well in his background?
No, he did not.
Okay.
But he had my mother's younger brother.
Mm-hmm.
Served in the Second World War in the infantry.
Okay.
He was captured in the Battle of the Bulge and spent almost 2.5 years in German prisoner of war camp. And he was, my mom was very deeply affected by that experience, because she was very close to my uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew about the Second World War. I'd studied, and seen movies, and had talked to my uncle, and he didn't like to talk much about the Second World War, and I think he was deeply affected by his experiences there.
Okay. What about your father and your father's side of your family? Did you have much contact with him or them?
I did see my father a little bit during growing up in my high school years, occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't take much of an active role in my youth,
mm-hmm.
or even too much later on, but because my parents had been estranged, but he did make an attempt to talk to me on a Christmas and mm-hmm. once, a little bit. And I did know his second family, my half sisters. They happened to be in the same school system I was, and I had a couple sisters in my high school,
mm-hmm.
so I knew them, and they had been invited to a birthday party a time or two. So I had a little bit of a contact with him,
mm-hmm.
but I never did talk too much about his military service. He actually served in the Coast Guard.
Okay.
My stepfather, on the other hand, who I remember and didn't know too well, because I remember my parents, my step-parents and my mother divorcing when I was in kindergarten,
mm-hmm.
but he had served in the Navy, and he had been on a couple ships that had been sunk, and so he had survived and come home a couple times for survivors, what they call survivors leave or something like that.
I see.
And so, but he was active in the war to some, but I didn't know him very well.
Okay. Who would you say were the stronger, the strongest role models for you as a young person growing up?
Role models?
People who you looked up to, who you wanted to emulate?
It would probably be my association with fellows in my scout troop in church,
mm-hmm.
and church Sunday school classes, men that took us on scout outings and that sort of activity.
Okay. Was that something that you were active in through most of your adolescence, scouting?
I was in Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, although Boy Scouts, I had one scout leader that was very active and got our troop organized, but then he, within a year or so, was transferred out, and so we had a few other scoutmasters come in and did a slipshod kind of an operation, but at least I had some men who, even though they didn't organize in the scout troop very well,
mm-hmm.
they at least took us on outings and spent time and saw that we got outdoors and did hiking and fishing and those types of activities. And I grew up with some close friends at church that lived nearby that had fathers that would take us fishing. And so I had a couple of very good men that devoted their time to their sons, and even some adopted sons like myself on activities.
Okay. Now, in what church were you raised?
I was raised in the LDS Church, the Mormon Church.
Okay. And let's see. And your brothers and sisters and your mother also attended?
My sister suffered from Down syndrome.
Okay.
And at the time that she would become old enough to go to school, my mother, being a single parent, had to give up her parental rights, and she became a ward of the state,
okay,
which was devastating to my mother.
Yes, I would imagine.
And from that time on, we would have to visit her on weekends and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
My brother, my mother, I think when she started working, she started a tobacco smoking cigarettes,
mm-hmm,
and because of that, felt herself not measuring up to the Mormon ideal, and therefore did not attend church, but thought it was important enough,
mm-hmm,
because of her background growing up in the church and her parents, mm-hmm, being Mormons, that she took my brother and I. And that's what she did. She would take us and pick us up.
Wow.
Take us and pick us up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
To our church and to our like scouting activities and weekday activities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So when you were graduating from high school, did you know automatically, immediately, that you did want to go to college?
Yeah, all the kids that I went to church with were very, they had college as a goal.
Mm-hmm.
And most of my kids, the kids I grew up with, were from the eastern side of Riverside, and their parents were professionals, like college professors, lawyers, doctors. And I and a few of my friends we're on the west side of Riverside. That's the kind of the poor side, and so. But we all met at church. So my associates at church always talked about college education. But my friends in my neighborhood I grew up in did not have college as a goal. And my mother, not having college experience, I remember her saying something like, "Well, if you could just graduate high school, wouldn't that be wonderful?" Because to her, that was, you know, that would be a major goal.
Mm-hmm.
And but then my friends at church always talked about, not if you're going to college, what college are you going to go to?
Mm-hmm.
And so I always got that as a goal. And so I always thought that I would go to Brigham Young University or try to.
Mm-hmm.
And but not having the finances to do so, it was, you know, I ended up going to Riverside City College,
mm-hmm,
and staying in town, which was difficult for me because my friends did go on to Brigham Young, and so it was, that was a tough time for me.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of felt like I was being left behind.
Sure. What and did you, when you entered college, did you know what major you wanted, the architecture?
Yes, I went right into engineering and architecture, yes, mm-hmm, classes.
Right.
And I took a business minor.
Okay. What year did you enter college?
I graduated high school the summer of 64,
mm-hmm,
and I completed 1 year at Riverside City College the year of 65.
Through 66.
And then that summer, mm-hmm, that's when, 65 is when I got my draft notice to go into Los Angeles and get a physical, because I was not in school during the summertime, and therefore, once I completed that physical and passed it, not wanting to join the infantry, I decided to go over to San Bernardino and join the Navy Reserve. And so I attended one more semester of college,
mm-hmm,
while I was going to the Reserve Center and deciding when I would go on active duty. And I applied at that time to go to become an electronics technician for the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for schools for me to attend. And sometime during that period of time, they came to me and said that they had secured a location for me, a position to go to a fire control technician school, which is basically the same electronics training, just instead of a general electronics career in the Navy, it would be more specific to gunfire control,
mm-hmm,
and the gun systems. And so I said, yeah, that sounded good. And so I got orders. They cut orders for me to leave Riverside and go to Great Lakes Naval Training Center to the Fire Control Technician School on Great Lakes.
Okay. Now, what did your mom think when you got your draft notice, were told that, yeah, you'd be going to Vietnam in the infantry if you didn't do something else, and then you go down to join the Navy?
Well, my girlfriend's father at the time was a captain in the Navy Reserve, and before my decision or being faced with the decision by going into L.A. for a physical, he had been telling me how I should consider going into the Navy Reserve anyway because of they have the great education opportunities. And so, but I had decided that I wanted to continue college and try to, you know, and the other thing was a lot of my friends were going on missions for the Mormon Church when they turned 19, so I had that in my background wanting to do. So I didn't really feel that I had military wasn't a major decision that I would choose to go into, but then once the military invited me through passing a physical and immediately going to be invited to go into the Army, I decided at that time that it would be best to go into the Navy Reserve program. And so that very night I traveled over to San Bernardino and signed up for Navy Reserve. And then just within a week or two, it's a good decision I made because they had about 350 people wanting to get in because of the huge numbers of college students that had been in, had lost their deferments.
Right. Okay. Did you choose to go in for the gunnery electronics training, or was that something that they kind of said, well, here are your options, you could do A, B, or C, and one of them was that?
Well, they gave us a battery of tests, and they told me that I had passed the test very well. Matter of fact, I could go into anything that the any schools that the Navy offered except for one, which was data systems technician. And the only reason I couldn't go into that is because to go into that training, you had to obligate yourself for 6 years in the military. And so my goal was to complete 2 years and then go to college. So I said, okay, well, I won't go into data systems. I'll do something else. Now, they didn't offer anything in architecture and engineering, of course, in those areas, but they did offer electronics, and I thought, well, that's something I haven't tried. It would be a field that would be challenging, and so I said, yeah, let's go into electronics. So I picked electronics technician as a possible course, but that's when they approached me and said, well, we don't have a billet to go to ET school, but we do have one for you to go to FT school, which is the same basic electronics training. So I said, sounded good to me, so that's when they decided to send me to Great Lakes and cut orders.
Okay. When you went into the Navy, when you first went on active duty, what were your first impressions?
Well, one thing that my girlfriend's father, the captain in the reserve, he took me aside one time and he said, Steve, I want to give you a little bit of advice. He says, there's guys that go in the military, and it's the worst 2 years active duty time of their lives, and there's others that say that it's their best 2 years. And all of it has to do with your personal attitude. And if you go into active duty as an adventure, an opportunity to learn, then you will gain a lot from it. And I kind of took that to heart. And so when I was sent orders to go to Great Lakes, to me, I'd never left Riverside. I'd never flown on an airplane. I looked at it as a great opportunity for new experiences and challenges. And so I think I had the right attitude. And to me, although electronics was challenging for me because I'd been the, you know, a C-plus, B-minus type of guy in school, and electronics wasn't easy for me, I also did pretty good. And I think I ended up in the 75% of my graduating class percentile. So I did pretty well. And so to me, it was a growth experience. My early childhood, I was always marginal as far as my abilities. Even my mother would talk to me about my difficulties with reading and classes and grades. And yet when I had passed so well in the training or the test in the Navy, and was said, "Hey, you're." I started to open up and expand, saying, "Hey, I am really I have an opportunity, and I'm not as have a difficult. How can I say this? My opinion of myself started to grow. I think because of my being raised by a single parent and difficulties in my life, I was probably, how should I say, my self-esteem wasn't what it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And through going into the military and excelling and doing well in the testing and going into electronics and doing fairly well, and seeing that, hey, I'm an intelligent guy, and I have a lot to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And my self-esteem really grew. So I think the military experience to that point in time was a very positive one.
How was boot camp for you?
Boot camp was 2 weeks after I joined the Navy Reserve down in San Diego.
Uh-huh.
I had an aunt and uncle that lived in San Diego that I was really close to.
Mm-hmm.
I went down and visited with them, and I went for my 2 weeks boot camp, and it was a little bit challenging and grueling, but at the same time, I think I did quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a good experience for me.
Oh, so you did that very quickly after you joined the Reserve?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
How long was that boot camp?
2 weeks.
The boot camp was only 2 weeks?
Yes. Naval Reserve Program is just a 2-week boot camp.
Okay.
It's very fast.
Yeah. Okay. Any kind of weapons training involved there?
No.
Okay. Just basic seamanship?
Yeah, basic seamanship, yes.
Okay. And when you went up to the Great Lakes for your gunnery and electronics training?
Yes.
If you would, describe, if you can, describe the type of system that you were being trained on and what you were being trained for your 2 years
okay.
in the Navy.
Okay, what it was is the fire technicians, FT school, they called it,
mm-hmm.
fire control technicians was the rating. It was a general electronics course, 18 weeks long, learning, the theory of electron flow and motor windings and the color code, the electronic color coding, just basic electronics and not too much specifics on equipment. The course was to give you a basis understanding for electronics so that when you went into the fleet, you would be able to work with those experienced electricians, fire control technicians on board the gun systems and be tutelaged and trained by them with on hands-on on the ship.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of gun system on the ships?
It was... Mark 1 Able computer servo systems,
mm-hmm.
5-inch gun mounts, radar directors. That was a whole system.
Mm-hmm.
And although we didn't learn too much specifics about the system
mm-hmm.
in school, we were just told at the time this is the training that you'll need to eventually work on this system. And I
mm-hmm.
expected to get orders at that time to go aboard ship on a destroyer or
mm-hmm.
an escort or something along that line and work with the electronics on that system.
Okay.
But as it turned out,
mm-hmm.
after graduation, the need for gunner's mates in Vietnam had gone up. We didn't know what they were using gunner mates for at the time, but I do remember an officer coming to our graduating class a week or so before graduation saying that they were short a number of people in their graduating gunner's mates class next door in the next building over,
mm-hmm.
and that they needed to get volunteers and also assigned people to fill those billets.
Mm-hmm.
And so we in our class had talked about possibility of going to Vietnam and or signing up to fill this need.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of us, and our instructors also told us this. They said, well, you reservists, there were 7 reservists in our class. You reservists are not going to get much practical experience aboard ship in electronics. And so you might consider, volunteering for this gunner's mate school. Mm-hmm. Anyways, and I don't know what it was that made me decide, but there was a bunch of us. We talked it over, and, hey, yeah, let's we don't feel that this electronics is really our bag. I still was thinking that engineering and architecture was eventually what I'd get into.
Mm-hmm.
And so we volunteered, about four or five of us, and I think a couple others were assigned. But there was seven of us out of our graduating class that actually got orders then not to go to the fleet, but to go into some sort of a training as a gunner's mate. And at that time, they didn't tell us what it was that we were going to be doing. And matter of fact, our advisors in our electronics class was saying they thought it was probably working at some naval facility in Da Nang or in Saigon someplace, doing some sort of work at the naval facility. That's all we knew at that time.
Now, the school, the electronics school, the fire control school that you went to, technician school, what was the most challenging aspect of that training for you, the FT school?
The challenging part was we had a lot of, in that class, that electronics class, there was a lot of them that were like me that had come out of college.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of them had been in electronics classes in college, so some of them were very knowledgeable to the point that when we started covering electron flow and electron theory in class,
mm-hmm.
We convinced, a couple of the fellows in the class convinced the instructor that the book was wrong on electron flow, the theory.
Mm.
And he went to the officers of the school to confront them about. Anyway, this went back and forth with him coming back saying, no, we were wrong, and he'd give us an explanation why, and then we'd convince him again that we were right, that this book was wrong, and this went back and forth numbers of times. So it was kind of interesting to me to see some of these fellows who were very sharp in electronics,
mm-hmm.
coming out of college,
mm-hmm.
challenging the book on electron flow and theory.
Mm.
And so there was a lot of dynamics going on with and finally there was a statement come from the officers of the FT school saying this and thus is so, the book is right, and we're not going to discuss it any further. So it was kind of fun.
Oh, that's funny. Now,
yeah.
Who were you most convinced by? The students that
I was,
were saying, or the?
I was convinced by the students, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting.
But at the same time, it was an in-depth study and discussion,
mm-hmm.
and it was over my head.
Uh-huh.
It was way over my head. Like I said, I was challenged as a student,
yeah.
in high school, so this was this was above me.
Now, do you think the students were they doing this just to distract from the class, or just to have something fun to do? Were they just?
No, I think a couple of the guys in this electronics class were very intelligent,
mm-hmm.
and I think they were correct. I think the
mm-hmm.
book was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I think what they had enough background in college,
mm-hmm.
and enough theory that they were very challenging to the instructor,
mm-hmm.
and convinced him, by the way, numerous times that they were right.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it was edicted by the officers that, no, the book is not going to be changed. That was an interesting dialogue.
Now, do you recall, would the change in the theory as it was presented by the students versus what was in the book, would that have substantially altered much of the instruction?
No, I think basic electronics,
uh-huh.
there's a lot of theory involved,
okay.
and interpretation, uh-huh. and maybe it, when it actually comes to practical use in the fleet, where you're actually running Ordals, running cable and hooking up the systems,
mm-hmm.
you're doing more of the maintenance and checking resistance on capacitors and resistors and doing the basic maintenance process of the system, and
mm-hmm.
you're not having to design systems.
Right.
So it was just an interesting
mm-hmm.
dialogue
mm-hmm.
about theory,
okay.
and didn't really affect much what we would be doing in the fleet.
Now, during this course, were they talking very much about the electronics involved in the early computers?
Yes.
Okay.
They did have a Mark 1 Able computer.
Mm-hmm.
It was, to me, it was very fascinating, the fire control system.
Mm-hmm.
They taught us in the books how to do the fire control problem, and that's where you have a target, an elevation, a bearing. Your ship is got an elevation or a bearing and a direction, and it has a stable element that tells the computer where the ship is relative to with the gyro. And then you lock in the radar on the target, and that sends the information to the computer. The computer constantly solves the fire control problem to point the guns in a position that would hit the target. Hmm. And so this was a mathematical process that you reached this conclusion, and yet the computer would solve this problem continually. Therefore, if you were standing by the gun mount, mm-hmm. as it was mounted on the ship, mm-hmm. The ship would be moving with the waves and the ocean, and the gun turret, it would look like the guns were moving up and down when actually the ship would be moving and the gun turret would be, the gun barrel would be fixed, locked on that target.
Mm.
So that was a fascinating thing for me to understand.
Mm-hmm. Now, this system, did it run anti-ship guns, anti-aircraft guns, anti-sub guns, everything? What?
At that time, fire control school was divided up into gun fire control systems and missile fire control systems.
Okay.
Now, if you took missile fire control system school, and this particular class that I was in was the introductory class,
mm-hmm.
and so we were designated fire control technicians, guns.
Mm-hmm.
If we wanted to continue on and take missiles, we would extend our education for another 6 months and take a missile control system, and I think you had to reach a certain element. You had to get a certain grade point average in class,
mm-hmm.
and you would be eligible to take the missile control system,
okay.
and become designated as missile systems. And a few of the guys in class did quite well and did elect to go into missile control. And then their orders kept them there at Great Lakes to go into the next phase of electronics training for missiles. But the rest of us, if we'd have gotten orders to go to the fleet, would have gotten orders to go directly to the fleet and learn more about specifics of gun fire control,
mm-hmm.
aboard ship.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, some of us at that time elected to go with the need of gunner's
mm-hmm.
mates.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
that kind of...
Yeah. You jumped over to gunner's mate school.
Yes.
Okay. What was that training? Go ahead.
But this is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't actually go over to the gunner's mate school. All we did is get orders cut
mm-hmm.
to go to do something as a gunner's mate duty in Vietnam, and we didn't know what that was. But what we did is we got orders to go to San Diego, and once we got there, we found out what we were being trained for was to be a gunner's mate on a river patrol boat.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think when you learned that?
Well, I was kind of, to me, it was a lot better than doing guard duty at some naval facility.
Right.
So I thought, wow, this sounds interesting. And immediately they gave us 1 or 2 weeks what they call counterinsurgency, which was like a propaganda about the war and general information about what was going on in Southeast Asia and that sort of thing. And then 2 weeks of Vietnamese language training, which there again, I think I had that attitude. I remember what my girlfriend's father said about taking advantage of all that the Navy has as far as training. And I looked at this Vietnamese language as challenging. I'd taken Spanish in school and done marginal.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, wow, this is interesting. But a lot of the guys didn't even try to learn during that two-week period. But I remember taking notes and really challenging the instructors and trying to repeat the phrases and words and trying to learn how to do the voice inflection,
mm-hmm.
whereas a lot of the guys there just didn't even try.
Okay.
To me, it was kind of interesting. And I think I did pretty well in learning the language, and in that meager 2 weeks worth of education, but it got a little bit of basic understanding and some verbiage, and
mm-hmm.
but that was interesting. And then, of course, then they said, okay, now we're going to teach you what you need to know before you go in country Vietnam, and you're going to do some training in survival training, and so we went to, we did survival training on the coastline, learned how to capture crabs and you know, learn how to try to find food and do that sort of thing.
Where did you
and
do
then
that?
We did that in San Diego at Coronado Island.
Okay.
Yeah, all this training took place at Coronado Island. Okay. They took us out to a jetty, and we captured some dead or found some dead fish, and we put the fish on. The only thing we were allowed to have was a K-bar knife and a parachute. So we took shrouds and rocks, and we made little nets, and we tied fish down and sunk them in, and we captured. By the end of the day, we had a 55-gallon drum full of crabs.
Wow.
And so at that night when we boiled them, we all ate pretty doggone well. We thought we were pretty proud of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fairly large class. I think it was about 100 of us or 150 of us.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't starve that night, and that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they carted us up by bus to Cleveland National Forest. And we did some night evasion courses and some day evasion courses. And we did map and compass. We did hiking. It was quite extensive training for, I don't know, a few weeks.
Okay.
Up in the mountains. There again, we weren't, we were on meager rations. We had no rations. We were supposed to catch what we could using snares. We would have classroom. Learning how to set snares, learning how to capture things, and then we'd go out and do some practical trying to do it, but there'd been so many classes through that we never found anything living up there. So our stomachs definitely started to shrink. but they did give us, they gave us some rabbits to kill, to learn how to butcher rabbits, and so if we had actually could catch some game, we'd know how to prepare it. The map and compass to me was fascinating. It was kind of, I'd had a little bit of training in Boy Scouts, so this was expanded on that basic knowledge, and it was, to me, fascinating learning how to get from point A to point B and get there successfully. And then also the day evasion courses were interesting, where they had enemy troops out in quite a large area, and we were to get from point A to point B and get, and then not be captured by the enemy. And if we got captured early, we would end up going to prisoner of war camp early. So the object was to stay uncaptured. And so I remember immediately my FT educated friends. We were all in this together, about seven of us. So we were going through the bushes, and I thought to myself that we were making an awful lot of noise, and I thought we were going to get captured. So I left them and went on my own, and sure enough, moments later, as I pulled up to a dirt road, I heard shooting and heard guys being captured, and as I was watching down the road, I saw them march right in front of me past as I was hiding in the bushes, and I saw the six guys that I just left moments before in that captured group. So.
Oh, no.
So I was able to evade capture, and I think the course was about 6 or 8 miles long. I was able to get to the ultimate goal. It was a freedom village where there was supposed to be some water waiting for us there, and I was able to evade getting captured. And when the program was over, a horn blared, and I noticed that there was enemy soldiers around the water that we were supposed to get to, and so it had rained that morning, so it wasn't that hot. So I just kind of took a nap behind the rocks, and then when the horn blew, I stood up, and there was about four other men out of the 150 that had made it there also. And so myself and these four others were trucked then to the prisoner of war camp, so we managed to stay out of that all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And then we spent all that night and the next day or so, day and a half, in a prisoner of war camp. And that was where we were interrogated, and we were a little bit abused. We were roughed up a bit. We were told initially before we went in the classroom what to do and say and not say. But then when we were my first interrogation, I remember them asking me some questions about filling out a piece of paper notifying the government that I was a prisoner of war, and I wasn't I didn't remember them saying that there was a piece of paper that we needed to sign. So, but it was, when I looked at the piece of paper, it looked like it was an official acknowledgement of being captured as a prisoner of war. So I put my name on that piece of paper, and then when I went back into the prisoner of war camp after the interrogation, mm-hmm. I was asking one of the bosun's mates there if you're supposed to sign anything in this piece of paper, and he said, oh, absolutely not. So I screwed up. So then anybody that didn't do something right in this interrogation, and then they later on that night were called back in for re-interrogation, and so then I understood exactly what to say and not say, and I didn't say anymore. And even though they got upset with me, and they would knock me with an open hand down to the sofa, and I'd bounce back up, and he'd knock me again, I got kind of belligerent and wouldn't say anything after that. And so finally, they stopped interrogating me and let me go in, and they didn't interrogate me again. So apparently, I passed. But what was interesting is when I went back into the prisoner of war camp later on, there was one of the guys that had been in our group that they came into our little bunker area where there was about 30 of us, and the commandant brought him in and said, "We have a college student here that knows a lot about the communist history, and he's going to lecture you." So apparently in this interrogation, he said too much and told them that he was a college student and knew something about communist history or something. And they got him to agree to come in and tell us about this communist history. And when he started telling us this stuff, I'm going, wait a minute, I know he's not supposed to be talking like this. What was interesting at the time, I'm going, wow, what is this guy doing? And then later on when this educational process was finished, and we ended up going back to Coronado, a bunch of us were talking about that experience, saying, what happened to that guy? And as we're getting on the bus to go up to the airport to fly to Vallejo for PBR training, we noticed he was out on the tarmac with a broom sweeping. And the thought crossed me at the time, I'm wondering who made the mistake. Maybe he was the one that was doing the right thing because he wasn't going to Vietnam and the rest of us were. So,
tough question.
Yeah, it was. I thought, well, there's an interesting thing. Either that guy's very intelligent or not too smart, mm-hmm. one or the other. I think maybe he knew what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, he stayed behind. The rest of us went on. We went on up to Vallejo. We trained on the boats. They did extensive training with us on the boats. They cross-trained us, so we all knew a little bit about everything. We knew about, but me as a gunner's mate, we primarily focused on the guns to the point where we could take, dismantle, and put them together blindfolded.
Mm-hmm. What guns were the 50 calibers?
50 calibers, M60 machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
M14s, mm-hmm. M16s, M79s, grenade launchers,
mm-hmm.
all those guns. They also gave us practical shooting on the boats in the at targets, but the ocean was, or the bay was very rough. And I remember after everybody shooting all day long at these probably 6 or 8 55-gallon drums with flags on them, when they towed them in that night, there was one drum that had one round, I think, in it. So they were pretty safe, but it was real rough out there in the bay that day. And I remember when they first got permission to fire, I was shooting on the forward 50, and at one moment I'd be pointing down about 20 feet from the boat in the water, and the next moment I'd be up pointing in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Almost straight up towards an airplane. So the water was so rough there was not much of a chance to get a good shot at any target.
Mm-hmm.
But we did, at least heard the noise and got to shoot the guns and that sort of thing. But then they did do war games with us. They took us back into the Susan Bay backwaters of the San Francisco Bay Area where there were canals and riverways that are much like Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And we, for a number of days, went back in there and did war games where we shot blanks and set up a perimeter and docked the boats and had an aggressor force attack us and So it was just getting us familiar with how the guns, the boats and the guns and the whole thing's operated.
Okay.
So that's kind of it as far as the training goes. Mm-hmm. And then from that point on, we got orders to go to the Philippines. We traveled by a chartered aircraft as a group.
Mm-hmm.
Our group by this time was about 28 men, about 6 or 7 officers, and the rest enlisted.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd all trained together up to that point in time. And they put us on a chartered flight to go to the Philippines. And in the Philippines, we went to Clark Air Force Base and went by bus to Subic Bay. And at Subic Bay, they took us for training, more jungle and survival training, and took us into the jungles for a number of days with a Negrito native to learn the practical aspects of survival,
mm-hmm.
How to get sources for water,
mm-hmm.
how to actually capture game.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this was fascinating to me because they taught us how to start a fire in less than 30 seconds by rubbing dried bamboo together. And this, I'm telling you, I tried it as a Boy Scout with the little bow and the wood and the soft balsa and hardly ever being able to get a fire started. But using dried bamboo, sliding across a V cut into another piece of bamboo with some scraped bamboo off the side, stuffed inside, and you could start a fire in 30 seconds. It was amazing.
Wow.
It was absolutely amazing. And then taking us out into the jungle, and they had taught us how to make snares, but we actually got to pull the bark off of trees, make twine, go into a tree fall area where we could see little game trails, and the Negrito native showed us how to set up a snare. And what was funny is we'd been hiking and walking, and so we were exhausted, but the Negrito native asked us if we wanted to set a bunch of snares. We'd done it in the classroom, but he said you should learn how to do it out in the open.
Yeah.
And all the group just sat there exhausted, and I volunteered, and he and I went out and set about 8 snares along a fallen tree.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was fascinating how to set these things up.
Yeah.
And I learned how to set a snare, and we were very successful. We captured, it looked like bandy chickens. They were a cross between a pheasant and a peacock.
Mm-hmm.
But we captured these birds, mm-hmm. and we ate them.
Mm-hmm.
And we also captured, using some spears, some fish in this little stream.
Mm-hmm.
So all in all, I think as far as food, we were quite successful to get food.
Mm-hmm.
And we also were able to find water. And I was fascinated by pulling certain colored vines down that were a kind of a reddish color.
Mm-hmm.
And the water coming out of those, you cut them low and then cut them high, and the water drips out. And this one vine, it was a sugar water. It was sweet water.
Mm.
And that was fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it was all quite interesting. I really enjoyed that training.
Mm-hmm. Now, this training for jungle survival, was that stuff that you were able to later use at all? Or?
Well, the idea was to hopefully not have to use it, but if you got blown off your boat and were in the jungle, you could have the tools to survive,
yes,
was
sir.
The theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there probably may have been some fellows that had to use that training once, somewhat,
mm-hmm.
but I never did.
Yeah. Now, the snares...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, you go.
No, the snares what?
I'm just going to say, the snares that you set, were these killing snares or just capturing snares?
Capturing snares, and that was another fascinating thing. He taught us how to set killing snares, but he says what's really nice about a capturing snare is that you can go out and set the snare and go off and do other things and then come back, and your game is fresh because the way it works, they walk across a trail that you set, and there's you put wood, a piece of sapling in the ground, and then lay bamboo across it, and then you pull the sapling that's standing down with a tight snare twine down to that loop that you stuck in the ground as a trigger, an off-sided little piece of wood that you tied the twine to, and then put the open loop on where he would walk. So when he stepped there, it would let that trigger slip, it would grab his feet, and the bird or whatever game you're trying to capture would be hanging by his feet. And sure enough, when we went to check the snares, that's how we caught them. We found the game hanging by their feet, sometimes 1 foot, sometimes 2 feet, but that's how we captured them. And they were just hanging there, waiting for us to come by. I mean, they're so that was fascinating to me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this will end the first interview with Steve Sumrall on the 26th of August. This is Steve Maxter continuing the interview with Steve Sumrall on the 27th of August, 2002, at approximately 3:05 Lubbock time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Steve Sumrall is in Renton, Washington. Sir, why don't we pick up with a discussion of some of the training you received prior to going to Vietnam. I was particularly interested in the insurgency and language training that you received. And if you would, what do you remember about, especially the insurgency training first? Anything in particular?
You mean as far as the training in the Philippines? They call it jungle warfare and survival training, I believe is what they called it.
No, this, I think, was something that you received prior to going to the Philippines, perhaps. Let's see here. I have it in my notes. I have it that you went up to, up for training on the riverboats, and then you received some training at Coronado Island in San Diego.
Yeah, that,
and that was for counterinsurgency, I guess?
Yes. That was the first part of our training. Once we got orders to go to Vietnam, we went to Coronado, and the first week or two was called counterinsurgency training, and I felt it was more of an introduction to the war in Vietnam, some of the political ramifications, some of the information about the communist activity in Southeast Asia. It was about the government of Saigon and Vietnam, and just gave us a lot of history and background and information regarding that, and more of a giving you information regarding the validity of our military stance to go to the defense of Southeast Asia. It was something along that line, pretty much. And then transferred into the immediate 2 weeks of language training.
Okay.
And then from language training, I went to survival in the ocean along the beach, and then transferred to survival in the wilderness up in the mountains of Cleveland National Forest.
Okay. Now, the counterinsurgency aspect of the training, did that also talk about the difference between the southern guerrillas, the Viet Cong, versus the North Vietnamese regular army, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it gave us a lot of definitions about the factions, some of the political wranglings of the North and the position of the South politically, and some of that kind of basis information.
Okay. Now, the language training you received, I assume that was with Vietnamese native speakers.
That's correct.
And how much did they talk about, in addition to some of the basic words and phrases and things of that nature, but how about Vietnamese culture, etiquette, things of that nature?
They didn't went into culture briefly, but because it was such a short amount of time for language training, they talked briefly about manners and a little bit about culture, but primarily they went right into trying to get you a fundamental basis for language, and that would be nouns and the construction of sentences and pitch, how you say a word so that it would be understood by the Vietnamese. Like the word ba has five meanings depending on the inflection of the voice. And so those are interesting things that we picked up on, and realized how to be fluent, it's pretty difficult and it takes a lot of practice. But at the same time, being immersed in the language on a daily basis as we would on the boats, it helped anyone who was interested in continuing to learn the education the ability to do so, because you were able to come in contact on a daily basis with the people.
Okay. Now, the coastal survival training that you received at Coronado, that was when you had talked about collecting the crabs and
that kind of
stuff. Did that? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That was just more to give you confidence that you could survive on your own if you needed to.
Right. Did that supplement or complement well the jungle survival and SEER training that you later received at Clark?
I'm sure it did. I'm thinking that they tried to give you a wide range of experience, because in the country, of course, there's a lot of topography, and you could be stranded on, I suppose, in a coastal area, mm-hmm. and also in the jungle. So they tried to give you a wide range of experience and training in those areas.
Okay. Now, when you found yourself in Vietnam, that the briefing that you received in the counterinsurgency training, how closely did that match the what you saw in Vietnam at first?
Well, not being able to speak fluently, I wasn't able to dialogue in depth with the Vietnamese people as far as political thought and culture and that sort of thing. Later on, I became more fluent and could speak a bit more, and but early on, that wasn't a main concern. Mm-hmm. The one thing I did learn and I felt good about was early on, one of my first assignments in My Tho as a boat crew was mm-hmm. to go and get ice at the ice factory in town, mm-hmm. and I became friends with the owner's two sons, who both were college students and worked part-time for their father, and they spoke very good English, and I was very impressed with their support of the South Vietnamese government, and particularly elections that were up and coming. They were very excited about the ability and the process of elections. And so I was quite impressed with their knowledge and their excitement about that freedom and ability to vote.
Okay. Well, when you left, when you finished your jungle and SEER training in the Philippines,
at that point in time, at that point in time, we were still a group of about 30 enlisted men and officers training. And when we completed that, we were supposed to get a commercial flight from the Philippines into Vietnam. But something happened, and we lost our scheduled flight. So we had to ferry out in small groups, helter-skelter. And so I remember we were kind of stuck in the Philippines for a week or so, and became friends with some of the Clark Air Force personnel, but eventually I was able to get out and fly on a C-130. The interesting thing about that flight was I was flying into country with a whole load on a C-130 of stretchers, and I remember staring at the stretchers, hoping that I wasn't on one of them coming back. And landing in Saigon, we processed through, I think it was called the Independence Hotel, or it was a naval facility for getting you transferred to your eventual duty station in Vietnam. And I remember finally getting all that those chores and assignments done, and then being ferried out of Tansanut Air Base on a what they call a Caribou, which is a small... It's like a miniature C-130 with a turboprop, and it has a rear door, and it's for ferrying troops in and out, and it's a very light aircraft. And it was myself and the Lieutenant Charles Witt that were assigned to take that flight to My Tho, where we would be assigned to the boat crews. And as it turned out, Charles Witt became the CO, or commanding officer, of 531, and I was assigned to 532. 531 went west on the river, and 532 went east on the river of My Tho. And he became CO of 532. I became assigned to the crew of the 131 boat.
Okay.
And we immediately started day and night patrols. Mm-hmm. Our assignment would be 3 day patrols, and then 3 night patrols, and 3 day patrols, with a transition of, 12 to 18 hours in between those stretches of patrols.
Wow. Now, when you first arrived in Vietnam, where did you land again?
We landed in Tansanut in Saigon.
Mm-hmm. What were your first impressions?
It wasn't... my first impression of a third-world country was going to the Philippines. That was an eye-opener for me. Me coming from Southern California, mm-hmm. and an American, never being out of the country, and never to seeing a third world country before, but seeing the poverty and the smells and sounds and seeing a different culture was quite an eye-opener. And then going into Saigon was much the same.
Mm-hmm.
It was wide, dusty roads, and you could see some poverty and, quite a bit of poverty. And all your signs in foreign languages. So it was a new experience for me, but it was interesting at the same time.
Mm-hmm. When you got off the plane and were, I guess, sent to some kind of a replacement company, perhaps, or what was the process of getting you from Tonsina to your unit?
The process was getting paperwork done. I can't remember all quite the details of the processes, but it was a few days of processing. I think it was, getting medical records straightened out and getting a personal weapon assigned to you, an M14, and eventually getting orders to leave by bus to the Air Force Base, the Tonsinut Base, to catch a flight to your ultimate duty station. And as I said, that's when Lieutenant Winton and I got orders to go to Mito.
Okay. Now, how many...
One other thing I might mention is the other impression I had when I landed in Tonsinut and seeing the facilities in Saigon was all of a sudden I realized I was in a war zone because everything had cages, metal cages around it, all of the bars, the restaurants, all of the military installations and hotels that Americans frequented had wire and cages and sandbags and barrels and lots of protection so that grenades couldn't be tossed into the buildings. Mm-hmm. So it was a stark reality that all of a sudden I was in a war zone.
Mm-hmm. Was there much gunfire the first few days that you were there at Tonsinut and Saigon being processed?
Well, that was early, that was February of 67, and I don't recall. It seems to me that there were some sounds, maybe artillery way off in the distance, but nothing like what I experienced coming home after Tet Offensive and a year later.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it was quite starkly different.
Yes, sir. Well, when you first arrived, what did you understand as far as, what the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam?
Well, my instructions were meager, but as far as I was told by the boat captain and probably my first patrol officer that our main duties was as a blockade. We were pictured with the duty and responsibility of going out on the river, taking and patrolling. We didn't have enough fuel to patrol all day or all night on our patrols, but a lot of times we would taxi out to a specific area that we were assigned to be, and we would check river traffic in the daytime. We would drift at night and try to conserve our fuel. And with the tide, we would drift in and out and move up and down the river and turn. And then we would check frequently with our radar. And primarily, we were blockade, making sure the enemy didn't have the ability to use the waterways to transport ammunition and contraband.
Mm-hmm. In the low-
and my first impression is there was some work involved getting the boats ready to go on patrol, some work in getting them when you're off patrol cleaned up, but primarily while you're on patrol, it was fairly mundane and not a lot to do. Read books, and if in the morning it was busy with river traffic coming and going, and evenings a little bit with river traffic, so that kept us busy searching sandpans and junks and checking identification papers. And some days we had some officers that were more wanted to be more eager and active than others, and we would have to turn up and down the river looking for people. Other officers would sit on station and wait for them to come by, and we would search them on a less intense basis. But in any case, we were a presence, and we were a police on the river, making sure that only the people that had a rightful duty and paperwork to transport up and down the river did so.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned just now paperwork. Would you, would some of that boat traffic on the rivers stop? You'd board, check documentation to see if they were legitimately transferring materials, or?
Yes, exactly. That's what our main assignment was. We would either call junks and sandpans that were moving up and down the river over to us, or we would move over towards them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we could have as many as 10, 15, or 20 sandpans and junks around us. And we would go out. One of our crewmen would probably have a shotgun on the bow of the boat. The other three would go out on the boats, checking them one after the other. They'd check lift floorboards, look for contraband. They would check manifests and they would check Konkuks. And we were had a brief instruction on what the paperwork should look like. And I think the first month or so, I don't remember having Vietnamese policemen on board, but later on they became a permanent stay. Each patrol would have one patrol officer and one Vietnamese policeman interpreter. But what was interesting is the Vietnamese interpreter, the Vietnamese interpreter did not speak any English. So, but he at least knew how to read documentation, and if there was any suspicious documentation, he would let us know. We would take that person in tow, take them to the local police station outpost, and then they would do further processing as far as get making sure the paperwork was legitimate, and if not, they would incarcerate those people. And another thing that we were to do, which to me was not as valid, but we were to check young men for their IDs and validate that they were not draft dodgers. And so sometimes the policeman would let us know that their identification was not correct or something and that they were probably draft dodgers, and we would take these young men into the police station for processing. It's usually a quick trip into the Army.
Okay. Now, when you first arrived, the base itself was at My Tho, right? The base.
Correct.
Okay. Your
Steve, are you there?
Yep. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me explain what that was when I got there. When I was first introduced and processed and met the CO of 531, and he introduced me to give me a brief introduction of what their responsibilities were and told me that I would be assigned to the 131 boat. I saw and was shown around that facility, which was the messing facility, the small EM club, and the few little outbuildings, the medical facility, and billet for some of the maintenance people. And then across the street was a new hotel that had just been completed called the Tara Lee Carter Hotel. It was a four-story hotel and has housed about, I would guess, probably 40 rooms that would house about four crewmen in each room. And I was on the third floor assigned to that room with that crew of the 131 boat. And the other facility was five blocks at the river, and that was the maintenance facility and where the boats and the pier and the dock were. And that, of course, had wire and guard gates on it and guard towers to protect that facility. And likewise, we had at the hotel a guard gate and guard on duty at those facilities.
Okay. Now, could you give me the complete unit designation that you were assigned to?
I was assigned to River Patrol Section 532 in My Tho, Vietnam. I'm thinking that they had probably at that time about 12 to 15 boats assigned to that patrol section.
And your boat was?
The 131 boat.
131. Now, was there a particular method used to number the boats?
Every boat had a number painted on it.
Right, but you know where the number came from? Was it just?
Oh, I'm sure it was derived from the brass plate insignia on the boat.
Gotcha.
There was a serial number of the boat. Mm-hmm. And that last three digits of the serial number was the boat designation.
Okay, gotcha. So, River Patrol Section 532, boat number 131. What did you fall under as River Patrol Section 532?
What did I fall under?
What did River Patrol Section 532 fall under?
Task Force 116.
It was Task Force 116. Gotcha.
Yes.
That's what I thought. Just want to clarify.
Yeah, and I think the overall call name of that organization was Game Wardens.
Right, the Game Wardens.
Yes.
Now, when you got there to My Tho for your first experiences and briefings, did you get any kind of briefing on rules of engagement, things like that?
Most of all, those instructions were given to patrol officers and patrol boat captains. The enlisted men were only followed direct rules of the boat captain, and he was so it was all these this types of rules and regulations were passed on down, and we usually got it through our boat captain.
Okay.
And there weren't a lot of rules. We were told to follow instructions, follow orders. One of the rules was when we got ready to go on patrol, I remember they were real careful to instructed us how to handle ordnance and machine gun ammunition, and we were always cautious to check headspace on the 50 caliber machine guns before we left on any patrol, and we would always take our ammunition and hook it up to the gun but not insert a round. We would pull a round back once it would engage the round out the belt and put it into the it's the housing that holds the round before it puts it into the barrel. And so you would pull around the handle of the 50 back once. You would extract the round and hold it in the bushing? I can't think of the word, and I should know.
Not the chamber. You're not talking about the chamber.
The chamber. It's it's the chamber of the 50.
Yeah. Okay.
But you didn't chamber the round. Didn't slide it forward and engage it into the barrel.
Okay.
So then, and then once you're on patrol, you would turn out, leave Mito, go around the island a few hundred yards, and then once you're out on the main river, you would pull the 50 calibers back a second time. That would arm the 50s with a chambered round, and then you would have is a safety button on the trigger housing, and you would have the safety on. And then if there was ever a need to fire, all you had to do is click the safety off and press the trigger.
Gotcha. Now, you as a gunner's mate, as your experience grew and as you went on more patrols, did the boat captain start sharing more information about rules of engagement and give you more discretion to make up your own mind whether or not you should engage, or how did that?
No, we were always under strict rules, and even the boat captain could not return fire unless he had permission to do so, and he would either call when we were going down the river and sometimes receive sniper fire. We always would call in for permission to return fire. Sometimes it was from an area that was called a free fire zone or an area that there was no question of friendlies, and we would get permission to return fire. Other times the rounds would come from an area that supposedly friendlies might be near, and we were not given permission to return fire. Yes.
So it was on a case-by-case basis?
Pretty much.
Now,
we were also instructed, even like we had a patrol officer on our boat, we were instructed not to engage or start shooting until we were given orders to do so. So one time I was in an ambush with a new first-class bosun's mate that was new in country. He was our patrol officer, and he was fairly elderly, in my opinion. Of course, I was a very young man at the time, but I thought he was a little old to being in a war zone, and he seemed to be very nervous. Well, one time we were in a very serious ambush with rockets fired at us, and he froze, and I kept yelling at him because I wanted to return fire with the M60 into the hooch that fired the round at us to suppress in case they were trying to reload, and I had to keep screaming at him to be able to return fire. And so finally I yelled at him loud enough and often enough that he said, okay, return fire. And I returned fire into the hooch, but it was a scary situation because the round had just hit 8 feet off of the stern of our cover boat, and then we were only about 20 yards apart. And that was a very harrowing experience, I remember. And but fortunately, they didn't get off another round.
Now, in some of the more extreme situations that you could find yourself or did find yourself, was there perhaps an intensity level of an ambush where, I mean, if you're taking heavy fire, you've got rockets coming in, you don't have time to be calling back for permission. You either better respond or you're going to die.
Yeah, that's correct. And generally, when we're going down the main river and taking sniper rounds, we are instructed to always have permission to return fire. There were times that we were in canals, that I was in a couple of ambushes in, that the fire started automatically. Both boats were under engagement of fire from the beach, and both boats started returning fire immediately, and I don't remember any radio traffic giving anyone permission. It just spontaneously happened.
Yeah. Okay.
I do remember on that first patrol that I was in a very serious ambush. We were on a day patrol we'd been on a night patrol and we turned around and went on a special operation with two other boats, so that gave us four boats, The commanding officer was a Lieutenant Webb. He rode on my boat, and we went into a canal because we were supposed to be doing a special operation, what they call it, a day recon patrol, because they had supposedly good information of a North Vietnamese company in the area. So we went up this canal, and interestingly enough, 4 days before, my boat had gone in the mouth of that canal. But this time when we stuck our nose into the mouth of the canal, there was some little yellow signs on either side that say that said Consot, which is kill zone.
Mm-hmm.
And we told the patrol officer that those signs had not been there 3 or 4 days previous to that. We went on in, us being the lead boat, and three boats following us all the way in. The plan was to go up 9 clicks, cross over on another little canal, and come back to the main river so we'd not have to backtrack.
Mm-hmm.
But what wasn't indicated on our map was an old World War II train trestle that was blown up laying in the canal. So when we got up 9 clicks, we had to turn around and come back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what the enemy knew we would have to do. And all the way out of the canal for 9 clicks, they had an orchestrated ambush on both sides of the canal at us, and they didn't fire at the first three boats. They would let the first three boats by the ambush site and wait for our boat. And then, because I think they knew enough about PBRs, they didn't want 12 50 caliber machine guns firing at them. They would wait till the three boats got by and then fire at our boat, the last boat. So we were taking intense fire from the aft quarter on both sides of our boat, and at that time when the shooting started, I was shooting the M60 machine gun on one toward, pointing one way on the boat, and the aft gunner was shooting the 50 pointing the opposite way. We were taking fire from both sides, so we were both shooting at each other's back, trying to suppress fire, and the Lieutenant Webb on the boat kind of got rattled and was yelling, "Where's the gun? Where's the gun?" Well, I was concentrating on getting my 60 machine gun firing, because it seemed like previous to this, and any time we took some rounds, we would return fire and they would not return back. In other words, they would go down into their bunker and stick their heads back up. But this time, they were intent on hitting us, because, and they were hitting our boat and hitting the water around our boat. And when I returned fire with the M60, it didn't faze them. They kept shooting continuously, so that was a shocker. And I started making concentrated bursts on the 60, and I didn't just stop at 10 rounds. I was buried through 100 rounds at a time, and I burned up a lot of ammunition in the short minutes that we were in that ambush. But as it was, the lieutenant kind of lost it and wanted to know what to shoot, and I just pointed at an M79, and he grabbed that,
mm-hmm.
And I continued to fire. I picked up the gun after I lost a target on my side because I couldn't stand hearing the firing on my backside and the rounds whizzing close by. So I turned, picked up the M60 off of the armor plate fitting and lifted up across the boat and started returning fire to the opposite side of the boat, helping the aft gunner suppress fire.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I noticed my brass, hot brass, and clips from the machine gun were hitting the boat captain in his helmet and flak jacket, but he didn't seem to mind too much. He just took his hand and was flicking the hot brass off his neck.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, then I realized they were shooting on the other side of the boat again, so I picked up the machine gun and returned fire pointing the opposite way. And that's the way we did all the last, say, 4 clicks of 4,000, 5,000 rounds to get out of the canal. By the time we finished getting out of the canal, I had burned up 5,000 rounds, that's 5 cans of ammunition. I was on the last can of ammunition, and I picked up the ammunition out of the well deck and put it on in the gun and pulled the bolt back, fired it. It fired about, 10 rounds, 20 rounds, and quit. And I thought it was because I was lifting the ammunition too far. I didn't pick up the ammunition and put it on the engine cover. I left it down in the well deck. I pulled the bolt back and returned fire a few more times, and the machine gun quit a second time, but by then we had breached to the main river and made it out of the ambush site. And lo and behold, an army barge happened to be transporting by, and so the lieutenant said, "Well, geez, isn't this fortunate? We can go and rearm and go back to the canal." Well, my crewman, the 50 caliber machine gunner up front, who had taken a lot of rounds real close to his turret he was showing me. And at that time, we were talking to each other, saying we didn't think it was a good idea to go back in there. But and then at the same time, the Army outpost nearby had listening to our radio traffic. They came up on our frequency and told the lieutenant that they had Alpha information that it was a heavy weapons company, that we a North Vietnamese heavy weapons company, and that they probably just didn't have time to set up the rockets. And that they didn't advise for us going back in the canal. And at that time, the lieutenant rethought his plan and decided we wouldn't go back into the canal. And as it turned out, it was a good decision, because that night when we got back to our base, I took the guns apart to clean them, and the firing pin in the M60 was broken right in half. And I still have the firing pin at home.
Really?
Yeah. But so that was a memorable experience. And we also, by the time we got the boat back, we kind of did a survey and counted 68 bullet holes in the boat. And the only casualty was the boat captain had a slight piece of shrapnel wound in his cheek on his face, but nobody else got a scratch. And it was a miracle for both myself and the forward gunner, because we both had rounds, armor-piercing rounds, because the rounds went right through the armor plate next to my leg. Three or four rounds went through it, just like knife through butter, nice and the little neat holes right through the armor plate, and up front on the turret for the Twin 50s, we were looking at trying to figure out how the forward gunner did not get wounded, because he had entrance and exits bullet holes on both sides of the turret, and if you put a stick through those holes, there's no way that he would not have been hit, but he did not get hit. So he happened to be having his body contorted or turned just the right way at the right time each time, and did not get hit. So we all kind of breathed a sigh of relief and realized how damn lucky we were.
Yes, sir. Now, how many members, how many crew members were on one of the boats? And we're talking about BVRs here.
River patrol boat, 31 feet long, twin 50 forward mount, a single 50 aft, M60 machine gun midships. We had a 60-millimeter mortar on board. We had 15 LAWs. That's a light anti-tank rockets. That was later on. The first 6 months we didn't have that. Later on we did have a little more armament. Generally you would have four-man crew, a boat coxswain and boat captain, a radioman, but the radioman would usually always be in charge of talking on the radio or shooting the M60 machine gun. Generally he was shooting, because the boat captain could drive the boat and use the radios at the same time, so that would give three men the ability to fire the forward 50s, twin 50s, and the single aft 50 and the M60 at the same time. Now, each two-boat patrol, you always had two boats. You had a cover boat and a main boat, and one patrol officer would be assigned for the two boats. So that would be one of the two boats would have a fifth man. The other boat would generally have the Vietnamese interpreter on board, at least on the day patrols. A lot of times the interpreter didn't go on the night patrols. Because there wasn't any river traffic and no reason to have them all night long on a river where they wouldn't be needed. And also the boats are very weight sensitive, so having any extra people on generally made the difference of whether you got up on step or not, which would increase your speed.
Now, and by that you mean when the boat reaches a certain speed, it literally lifts up in the water.
It lifts up, and when you're on step, that's you're going your maximum speed, say between up to 25 to above 30 knots, you can be going that speed and doing it in very shallow water. They said at speed, and we did it many times running the beach, we could be in as low as 4 or 5 inches of water.
Wow. So it's
and you'd also get up and plane, because your jets would be pointed down slightly. You'd hit them in, the jets would hit the mud, and you'd get a little more, you could actually go a little faster if you run the beach. Of course, this was very hazardous duty, because the enemy would love to be able to set a claymore in the tree and command detonate it if a PBR happened to come by. So we did not try to do that often, and we weren't very predictable about it. We would do it once in a while, maybe sometimes too often, and sometimes some boats were devastated because they either were hit by rockets or claymore mines.
Wow. Now, the enemy that you found yourself up against, were these principally Viet Cong, NVA, or a combination?
The first 6 months I was there, the engagements I was involved with were primarily Viet Cong. We generally would take harassing rounds or sniper rounds, usually in the evening. Mm-hmm. If we got the opportunity to return fire, they usually would not return fire.
Okay.
But later on, towards the last 6 months of my duty there, more NVA seemed to be in the area. There was more trained. They seemed to be more regimented and more steadfast in their ability to engage us. And they didn't seem to put their heads down and hide. They would keep trading shot for shot with us.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Another boat characteristic, its primary composition was fiberglass. Is that correct?
That's correct. Fiberglass, 31 feet long, 15 feet wide, twin six-cylinder diesel engines, mm-hmm. Cummings, mm-hmm. and twin jacuzzi pumps.
Okay. And those, the hull of the boat, it allowed for rounds to go through, and it would maintain its buoyancy, correct?
That's correct.
To a point, yes.
Matter of fact, I talked to James Elliott, the Medal of Honor winner. He was stationed out of Mito. Mm-hmm. He was there the first month I was there was his last month there.
Okay.
And I remember him talking to my boat captain, who they apparently had gone through training together, and he was telling him how in what he called the turkey shoot, which was one of the engagements that he won the Medal of Honor mm-hmm. in, he was had a recoilless rifle, a 57-millimeter recoilless rifle, fired at his boat. It went clear through the forward part of his hull, mm-hmm. the bow, mm-hmm. and actually went through to the other side of the canal and killed other enemy soldiers. had it exploded on the boat, it would have done devastation to the crewmen on the boat, but in fact, it actually penetrated, made a big hole, mm-hmm. but it went all the way through and ignited on the other side. And he was telling my boat captain how fortunate that their rockets had gone through and actually killed their own troops on the opposite side of the ambush.
Mm-hmm. And these are B-40 rockets?
The ones he was talking about, they were 57 recoilesses, although I saw a number of boats that came into Mito from the 531 section that had been hit by B-40 rockets. I didn't have any B-40 rockets fired at us. We did have a 57-millimeter recoilless rifle fired that one time that hit between our boats, but mm-hmm. didn't hit either one of them.
Mm-hmm. What was the heaviest thing your boat was hit with while you were on board?
The heaviest thing that I was hit with was small arms automatic weapons fire.
Okay.
And one ambush we were in, we actually had a grenade lobbed at us. They hadn't started shooting at us yet, but when we came into this area where there was some hooches and people that normally had been plowing the farms, this time when we came in the canal, they ran. So they'd never run before, so we knew something was different. But when we got close to the village, the canal takes a 90-degree turn, and right as we did our turn, the patrol officer with Lieutenant Craig was on the forward boat. They went first by. Mm-hmm. Then we came by, and there was a hooch right at that 90-degree turn. And out of the doorway of that hooch, a grenade was tossed. It went up into the air. It seemed like it was slow motion. Mm-hmm. My mind went into like a slow motion mold. It seemed like it hung there forever. And I thought it was going to hit the river. And I remember changing my mind numerous times, thinking, yes, it's going to hit our boat. No, it's not. Yes, it is. Finally, it hit the gunwale. I thought it was going to roll out. It rolled into the boat. The aft gunner and I both jumped forward of the engine covers and ducked. And at the same time, I'd been counting. And after I got 5 seconds or 6 seconds, I jumped up and picked up the M60. And I remember the forward boat, after that grenade had been tossed, I heard shooting forward of us where our cover boat was. I automatically started shooting when I heard that shooting going. I just returned fire into the hooch in case they decided to try to throw another grenade. And at that same time, my aft gunner picked up an extra flak jacket and threw it on top of the grenade, and then he started shooting the F-50. The grenade never did go off. It was a dud. And the boat captain it was an interesting grenade. It was what you call a Chinese communist grenade.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like our old World War II pineapple, but it didn't. It had the pineapple marks on it,
mm-hmm.
but it had a long cast iron neck.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently their these Chinese grenades have twine or something that they pull to arm the charge.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I guess they wick water down that twine cord that they pull, and a lot of them apparently are duds. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, this one was also.
Wow.
But he got to keep that as a souvenir.
Okay.
They took a knife to it and dumped the TNT out of it.
Yeah.
I remember him very proud of the fact that he got a souvenir.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have a lot of, not just on the rivers and the river traffic that you obviously had to engage and interact with, but in terms of interacting with Vietnamese people in general, did you have a lot of contact with the Vietnamese?
We did. Mm-hmm. We did. Also in town, if we weren't on patrol, sometimes we would. They had some little restaurants and bars along one of the canals that we would go in and sometimes get tired of the food at the mess hall and go down and order, I think it was water buffalo.
Okay.
They called it beef, but it was water buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And fried potatoes and salad, which is as close as we could get to a steak and salad. And we'd also go down and drink their, I didn't drink at the time, but my other crewman who drinks the 33 Bombay beer,
mm-hmm.
Bombay Bob beer.
Mm-hmm.
But so we did that. We went to and got our sometimes our black and white film processed at the little Photoshop there that we got to know. We also would go to the tailor shop and sometimes get tailored greens made for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We would, like I said, go to the restaurant. So we did go around and became familiar with Mito and the people there and the businesses. We would also go down to the marketplace. We would buy penny candy and that sort of thing. And when we were on patrol, we'd go into an outpost. And anytime we'd get to an outpost, maybe 100 young kids would come running up, and we'd hand out either leftover sea rations or sometimes we'd have bags of bag candy that we'd purchased at the market and hand out bag candy. We also, like I said, did a lot of dialogue with the people coming and going on the river.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we saw them so often we got nicknames, that we'd pick for them because we couldn't.
Because you
a lot of times they were derogatory nicknames. But,
okay.
But
but you could. It was hard to pronounce their names.
Some not so. A lot of Americans don't want to go to the effort to try.
Yeah.
So it's much easier just tag them with an American name.
I see. Now how did the Vietnamese typically respond and react, especially when you stopped them on the rivers?
Well, most of them knew what the rules were on the river. They knew that we were like the police station on the river.
Mm-hmm.
They knew to transport the... And a lot of them, to get their permission to travel, they'd have to go to the local village chief or the province chief and get their paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were instructed what to do. They knew that they had to follow orders. If we called them over, they had to go over and do for an inspection. So they complied pretty readily. Every once in a while, if somebody was, you're on one side of the river and somebody's on the other trying to go by and not come over to you, you'd have to shoot 3 rounds up in the air to get their attention, and then they would turn 90 degrees and come right over to you generally.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, somebody pretended they didn't hear, and sometimes you'd have to shoot a round or two across the bow, but generally they would know we were there. We'd shoot a couple rounds, and they'd see us. They'd come over.
Mm. Now, what if they didn't respond to the shots going across their bow?
Well, we were always told to drop what we're doing and chase those people down because maybe they were Viet Cong, moving or knowing they had contraband on the boat, and that would be a good reason to stop what you're doing and go after them.
Okay. Now, what else besides weapons and explosives and ammunition would you consider contraband?
Generally, we were instructed that they are only allowed to carry rice and certain commodities if they had permission, and their manifest said they were allowed to move that quantity of rice. Because of our limited Vietnamese, a lot of times it was better for the Vietnamese interpreter, the policeman, to make that determination if they had the right amount of rice based on the paperwork. If it wasn't, that would be grounds for taking them into the police station for interrogation.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a black market on rice because mm-hmm. the Viet Cong army also needed rice.
Right.
So it was all, they monitored that. I never, in all the months that we checked traffic, Never came across any munitions of any kind, although other PBRs did.
Mm-hmm.
Ours didn't. And there were some incidents where we had major crossings of enemy junks and sandpans. And of course, those were enemy crossings at night. They knew, and there again, night time was a little different. You didn't have traffic. The rule was it was a curfew. Mm-hmm. Nothing was allowed to move on the river at night. If they moved on the river, it was free fire, and so, they knew that. All of the South Vietnamese people knew that.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that one of the biggest differences between your day operations and night operations? Was your you don't need permission to fire on anything at night?
That's correct.
Okay. What other big differences were there between day operations and night operations?
Well, a lot of times, sometimes you would just drift. Sometimes we'd have one or two guys up and two guys sleeping, and you would bestell each other after two or three round hours.
Mm-hmm.
And you would usually drift.
Mm-hmm.
The person in charge of the his watch had the responsibility to check like once an hour or once every half hour on the radar, turn it a few times to make to a sweep to see if there was anything moving.
Mm-hmm.
Because conceivably they wouldn't have to light an engine off. They could paddle across.
Mm-hmm.
But generally they would try to go quickly and use an engine, and you could hear them do that.
Right.
But radar could be a good check to determine if anything was on the river. We also used a night scope,
mm-hmm.
Night light scope,
mm-hmm.
Which aren't as good as the ones they have now, but they worked, you know, to some degree, especially if there was a little moon up or little stars, you could see pretty well with those, and binoculars.
Now, what was the range of the radar you used?
About 6 miles.
That's pretty good.
Yep.
And did you have to turn the boat on to use the radar?
You could do a sweep once or twice without turning the engine on, but it drained the batteries pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just did a couple of sweeps and turned it off, it would probably be okay. But if you tried to do more than that, you needed to light the engines off and just leave them in neutral and do a sweep and then turn it off. We didn't like to do that because if they turn the engines on, then the enemy would know where you were.
Right. Okay. Well, this will end the interview with Steve Summerall on the 27th of August. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Steve Summerall on the 28th of August, 2002, at approximately 9:05 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Summerall is in Renton, Washington. Sir, we're going to continue this morning's discussion of your time in Vietnam. We had talked a little bit about some of the activities and some of the combat that you saw. Were there other particular events, incidents that you wanted to discuss today?
No, I would just go over and review some general activities, you know, on a month-to-month basis.
Okay, that'd be great.
Okay, to start, I wanted to mention that one of the responsibilities we had, other than being a blockade force and kind of policing the river traffic, was also a resource for the outposts and for the communities up and down the river sometimes they called us the ambulances of the Mekong Delta.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times there was wounded or I remember a number of times going to the aid of South Vietnamese officers' wives that were ready to give birth. And so we were the ambulance to take them to the hospital in My Tho. And other times there were wounded at outposts that... hold on just a minute. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, we were utilized often to for emergency care, getting people from point A to point B quickly to the hospital. And I was going to mention that one time one of the more horrific experiences on the river was going... being called over to the outpost at Mendai, which is close to the mouth of the river that opens up into the South China Sea. At that outpost, we'd been there numerous times, either taking detainees in for questioning or picking someone up and ferrying them into My Tho or whatever. And this time we got a call in the evening to come in, and no explanation. But when we got there, our cover boat was further down the river a number of miles, so we weren't close by. So it was an emergency call to come quickly to the outpost, and there was a large pier there. And so we went to the pier, and when we approached, it was covered with probably 75 or 80 people on the pier as we were pulling up at dusk. And when we got there, they were all screaming and yelling. And what had happened is the Viet Cong had mortared the children as they were let out of the school. And the school was on the edge of the rice paddies next to town. And so they were coming across the rice paddies to come home after school, and the Viet Cong mortared the children.
Oh, my goodness.
So there were 30 wounded children. And we got there, and the boat captain had me. I was on the forward gun tub and had me. We put the boat nose first into the dock, and we couldn't allow the parents to ride to Mito with their children because the boat is so weight sensitive, and just getting the 30 children to Mito in any kind of a time frame necessitated that we keep the parents on the dock at bay, and then we hand carried the wounded children one by one onto the boat. And so the boat was totally loaded down with 30 wounded children, and I was forced to keep the parents who wanted to, of course, be with their children mm-hmm. to go to the hospital mm-hmm. to stay behind, and it was just a horrific experience. And then I remembered trying to get to Mito as fast as we could. We couldn't because we couldn't get the boat up on plane because we were so weighted down, and so instead of taking maybe 40 or 45 minutes to get to Mito, it took like an hour and a half.
Oh, my.
And so some of the children were so severely wounded that five of them died on the way in to the hospital. And so at the time, we're sitting on the boat trying to figure out, there's nothing we could do to make the boat go any faster, nothing we could do because we weren't medically trained to be able to be much assistance to the children. And it was just... And finally getting to the base and then offloading the wounded children and realizing so many of them had died on the way in, it was just, that was a horrific experience of my life.
My goodness. There was no other boats in the area that could come to your assistance?
No, and no other boats. The only thing we could do is try to get to the hospital as soon as possible, and the most direct route was taking the boat as fast as we could in.
Oh.
And no other boats close by. So it was a dire situation. And probably not uncommon to a lot of experiences of fellows there in that arena
mm-hmm.
On boats like that. But many of them had similar stories, you know, having to deal with a horrific situation like that.
Did you witness any other incidents of Viet Cong terrorism?
That was the most stark one that I saw there, although we'd heard and of incidents of brutality and, of course, unauthorized taxation of the people. A lot of times the people on the river would come to us and tell us they had just come out of a canal and mm-hmm. and had been taxed by a North Vietnamese taxation station illegally set up. And so there was a lot of that kind of thing that went on. The people would complain, but we couldn't do a lot about it.
Mm-hmm.
We might, I'm sure the boat captain would pass it on, the information on to our TOC
mm-hmm.
Officers, and that would be distributed. But we had the incidences like that. But that was that one incident of mm-hmm. picking up the wounded children was probably the most horrific for me.
Goodness. Now, did your unit and did your boat participate in very much civic action?
So yes, we did. I was meaning to mention that also.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We had a lot of opportunities to take things out to the people and disperse them. Soap sometimes. We had vegetable oil that we handed out numerous times. Leaflets, information. Also, there was, political campaigns, Chu Hoi programs, where we handed out leaflets to invite the enemy soldiers to give up, and they would be fairly treated, and, you know, some of those propaganda and military programs. But Yeah, civic action. Another time, a number of times we went on some special operations where we took some doctors and nurses and took them out into what we call the boonies, the areas that were less controlled by the South Vietnamese government, and tried to. A lot of times it was set up by province chiefs that they would ask for assistance or a sponsorship, and we would. This one time we took four boats with doctors and nurses and went down on a canal that I wasn't familiar with, but it was much further south, very small, and in my opinion very dangerous, traveling in this small narrow canal many miles down south into a small hamlet village, offloading the doctors and nurses for the day, and they went in and treated the children and elderly and those people who needed medical assistance in the village. The village head,
mm-hmm.
Invited the officers and the nurses and everyone for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
We got there early in the morning. When we were on our boat, the rest of us stayed on the boat, of course, maintaining the boat and keeping watch. And we saw a couple of fellows come down with a couple dogs and prepare the dogs in the river. They killed them and cleaned them and took them back up to the village. And so we kind of figured that that was what was going to be served for lunch. So then when the boat captain came down later and said we could come up one at a time and share in the luncheon,
mm-hmm.
we told him thanks a lot, but we'll just stay and eat our sea rations. And
mm-hmm.
and then, of course, they all came down later that evening, and we all left, and they all said that lunch was very good. And we said, yeah, we figured it would be.
Mm-hmm.
But that was kind of a comical situation.
Did you tell them what they ate?
Later on, we said, yeah, we saw them preparing lunch for you guys, and we told them, and they said, well, it tasted good to us.
Okay.
But dog is a readily used resource for
mm-hmm.
food in Vietnamese area.
Yes. Now, what was the strangest thing you did eat?
In Vietnam, we had, we'd go to the restaurant. Sometimes we'd have... first time I ever saw a lobster fully, not prepared, and you had to crack it open. But, yeah, we had some good fish and lobster. But as far as unusual food, we did sample what they call nuoc mam, which
mm-hmm.
is actually fish sauce.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it prepared on being made along the river. You could smell the nuoc mam factory on one of the rivers for about 5 or 6 miles down the river.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think I'd ever want to ever sample that, but one time we did have lunch at a friend's house, and they had nuoc mam, and they put it on the rice, and it was very tasty.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as other unusual delicacies, they have a lot of very nice fruits in Southeast Asia, some that's not recognizable by us here in this country. And I remember one time we were checking on junk, and the Vietnamese policeman who I was friends with at the time called me over and called this fruit boom kaw, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a kind of a light green on the outside and about the size of a pear, but it had looked kind of like a pomegranate. It had little tufts of stuff on the side of it. Anyway, he said, oh, these are very good, we need to buy some. So we paid the farmer some piastres and took a few of them on board, and later we broke them open, and they were light pink on the inside and very delicate and tasted like strawberries.
Hmm.
And they were very delicious. They had large, big seeds,
mm-hmm.
like looked like an apple seed, only about 10 times larger.
Hmm.
But the flesh was like strawberries. That was a fun fruit to eat.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times they had these little... I don't know the name, lychee nuts or something.
Yeah, lychee. Mm-hmm.
Lychees, and they would peel them. They would have kind of a crust or
mm-hmm.
a rind that we'd peel down, and then the inside was kind of like a jellied, lime-colored lychee.
Mm-hmm.
They ate those. I didn't eat any of those, but mm-hmm. I guess they're pretty good. I just didn't choose to eat any.
Did you see any durian fruit?
Durian?
Durian. Does that
No, I didn't.
Okay.
That doesn't ring a bell with
okay,
me.
Okay.
A lot of stuff was eaten and seen. Sometimes I chose to try it, and sometimes I didn't.
Okay.
And didn't know, always know just what the name of it was.
Yeah. Okay. What about other psychological operations. You mentioned passing out leaflets, Chihuahua leaflets. What about loudspeaker operations?
We did some of that also. Mm-hmm. Took the loudspeaker on the boat. The Vietnamese policeman or interpreter mm-hmm. would go out, and we would use the megaphones mm-hmm. and try to persuade people to come over to our side.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times our boats were used for special operations in conjunction with major efforts by the military, the Army.
Mm-hmm.
We worked with the monitors and mic boats that ferried the 9th
mm-hmm.
Division
mm-hmm.
in the Delta around. And so, like I mentioned, we would escort them to and from certain battle areas or even help set up a blockade on some rivers and canals as the 9th Division was doing a moving operation trying to pinpoint or push an enemy battalion a certain direction. Sometimes it was a joint operation with ROC soldiers, that's Korean
mm-hmm,
soldiers,
mm-hmm.
and South Vietnamese ARVNs.
Mm-hmm.
And invariably, this was a two or three or a week-long operation, and invariably one of the nights the enemy would seem to walk right through the South Vietnamese Army lines and escape. So sometimes we didn't have a lot of faith in the South Vietnamese capability of maintaining an effort.
Did you ever hear any information as to why or how that occurred?
I was never privy to that. My impression was that they were very poorly trained and not very motivated soldiers, and that probably had something to do with it.
Okay.
I know later on when I was about ready to leave country, the city of Mito was under attack during the Tet Offensive, and I always thought that the hotel that we billeted in and our messing facility was relatively safe because we were one block from an ARVN battalion headquarters,
mm-hmm.
and there was, I think, close to 5,000 ARVN men just within the block of us.
Mm-hmm.
But when the attack to the city took place, the 500 men, or the battalion-sized men, up and left and vanished. And so when the city was under attack, to put this in perspective, my River Patrol Section 532 had left to go on an LST. The other patrol section had left previous to that to go on an LST. So when our section left, that left all the PBRs gone and only the maintenance crew in Mito for that period of time. And five of us who were due to go home were stranded there with the maintenance crew, and the only other Americans in the city of Mito at the time were the two SEAL teams. And so when our billet came under attack and the city was under attack, general attack, the SEAL team set up the perimeter, and I really feel was the reason that the enemy soldiers didn't try to take our compound was because of the resistance of the SEAL teams, and they went around us instead of through us. And they did mortar the hotel, and the water tank up on top got hit, and it was like Niagara Falls. And it was that week-long battle was pretty intense.
Mm-hmm.
And us PBR soldiers, navymen, felt out of place because here we were used to being on a riverboat and felt that that was where we should be, but we were stranded there in town with no assignments and felt pretty vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And glad that the SEALs were there.
Now, did you work very much with SEALs on the rivers?
Yeah, actually, numerous operations the SEALs would utilize our boats, and numerous times I was involved in those operations where we would take a SEAL team out, maybe six or eight men. We would go out in the evening on an evening patrol. They would want us to drop them off at a specific location, and we would insert them into the jungle. They would drop off. They would arrange to have us pick them up in the morning at a certain coordinates, and maybe 10, 15 miles across the landmass that they were on, and we might pick them up on another canal or another river that next morning, and numerous times they would have engagements. Sometimes they'd have no engagements. And a few times we were able to support them on their extraction, in that one time a SEAL team was close, within a click of us, to coming home, coming onto the boat that early morning, and they ran into a company of North Vietnamese and got pinned down between some fallen coconut palm trees, and they were pinned down so tight they couldn't extract themselves. And we happened to have a 60-millimeter mortar on our boat, and the boat captain knew that I was the only one trained to fire the mortar. The crew was fairly new, and he offered the idea of lobbing mortar rounds over on the other side of the SEALs to hopefully allow them to extract. They readily agreed to that. I was reluctant because the mortar is very inaccurate, and you're holding it like a Kentucky windage. You know, you have a base plate and no way of, it's not like an infantry mortar where you can set exactly bearing and, but on a boat, because the boat is moving on the water, you just hold it. And I was really apprehensive, and I put on an extra clip. I left more of the little packets of explosive rounds. They have little packets clipped to the fins for maximum distance, and I left more than I thought I needed on, because I didn't want to hit close by the SEALs, and I did lob too far the first round. They told to adjust about 50 yards closer in, so I tried to hold it a little more upright and lobbed the next round. They said it was on target, so I took the, we only had about 15 or 20 fragmentation rounds, and I just lobbed one after the other. My crewman would take and arm the round, and I would drop it in the tube, and we lobbed those over on top or past the SEAL team, and they were able to, we were able to keep the enemy heads down enough so that they could extract and pull out of the ambush site and be able to make it to the boat. And we backed up and got out of there, and no casualties. So, that was a close call. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the SEALs were very happy that we had a mortar on the boat that day.
Did you
But we worked with the SEALs numerous times, and that was one incident.
Did you have any other hot extractions, that kind of stuff?
That was the only one that was a really hot extraction. A lot of times they'd gone in, they would go into an enemy position and at night and creep in and set up booby traps and then extract themselves and meet us at a different coordinates, and we'd pick them up, and with no special happenings, just they were fortunate. And, and a lot of times, I mentioned that the SEALs seemed to be very good at what they did on all their operations, because they were they didn't set up a base out in the jungle like the Green Berets did, and so they would use any form of transfer, our boats or helicopters or various types of transportation, to go and do an operation and then come back. So they're very unpredictable, and it was hard for the Viet Cong or the NVA to actually engage them. They only were engaged when the SEALs wanted to be engaged, and so I think because of that, they had less casualties than, say, the Green Berets did. Because the Green Berets would go out into the jungle, set up a perimeter base, and then do operations and patrols, and they'd always have to come back to that base, and the enemy knew it, so the enemy could set up a ambush and ambush them on the way in. So the SEALs worked a little different operation and utilized the transportation like our boats, and was able to solve that problem.
Now, what were your impressions of the Korean forces you worked with?
My impressions of the ROK Koreans were that they were extremely professional, excellent soldiers. I know when Tet was under attack that time, my crewman that we were waiting to hopefully for the battle to subside, that we could get to Saigon and get to go home. And in the meantime, because we didn't have an assignment, one lieutenant in a jeep came by and picked myself and two other men. We got our M14s, and we had to escort him to Army communication center just outside of town. And this is while the city was under siege, so it was kind of a it was a very rough time. We were going through the city, and there was lots of snipers and a lot of shooting going on, mm-hmm. and we were going from alleyway to alleyway and streetway to streetway, and then we got under attack and pinned down by a sniper, mm-hmm. and down the street came a platoon of rock soldiers, mm-hmm. and they said they heard the shooting, and they came to our aid, and they said, "Where is the rounds coming from?" I pointed to roughly where I thought the rounds were coming from, and they charged the position like they were in a tank,
hmm.
and I was quite impressed. And that's the way they were. They were animals.
Hmm.
They were very impressive, very aggressive soldiers.
Okay.
And I heard that from other operations. They said that anytime the rock soldiers were involved, working coordination with the night division, they were always well thought of and very dependable.
Okay. So why don't you describe how the events in your area of operations unfolded during Tet of 1968?
During the Tet?
Yeah, during Tet 1968. What happened where you were?
Okay. As the Tet started, I was on a night patrol the first main evening that Tet hit.
Mm-hmm.
And we were drifting on the river at night. Now, we were familiar with the
Okay, go ahead. So you were saying that Tet 68, you were familiar with something.
Yeah, you know, I was saying that we were out on the river at the start of the Tet offensive. And at midnight, I noticed a lot of tracers going up into the air. And as I turned around in 365 degrees, I could see tracers all the way around in a circle. So I knew there was a major offensive going on. And I listened in on the frequency of the Army, and I could hear the outposts that were requesting, air support.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, everywhere was under attack. Mm-hmm. And the people on the other end would say, well, we wish we could help you, but, you know, the call sign of that particular air support, they're busy. Puff the Magic Dragon, no, we don't have Puff in the area, he's busy somewhere else. Or they would do other call signs for other support, air support, and they'd say, no, they're busy somewhere else. The radio would go quiet, and then I'd hear the radio come up again and other outposts requesting air support also, that they were close to being overrun. And there would be no air support for them.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'm listening there, sitting on the river, and knowing that some of these outposts were not too far from me, and some of them had given us artillery support in the past, and we were sitting there and couldn't give them any aid or support, it was a real feeling of ineptitude or I don't know what the proper word is. I felt like I wanted to go to their aid and help them and couldn't. But listening to their dire situation, and then they would come up on the radio and say, "This is our last transmission. They're coming over the wire," and they would click. And I heard that during that night. I heard at least four or five outposts go off the air that way.
Oh, goodness.
And it was devastating to me, too.
Did you
not be able to help them?
Yes, sir. Did you you and your crew members, did you expect what happened? Was it a surprise when Tet hit?
It was. I think in the past, during the past years, Tet, there had been some harassment and some incidents,
mm-hmm.
but nothing major like this. And so it was a surprise, yes.
Yes, sir.
And then coming home, of course, there had been harassment at Mito,
mm-hmm.
and then going on subsequent patrols, there had been much more activity on the river.
Mm-hmm.
And at night, more outposts under attack. And then that's about the time that the River Patrol section left to go on an LST and left us five that were due to go home to stay behind. So during Tet going on,
mm-hmm.
being left behind in Mito, that was a very upsetting time for me.
Yes, sir.
Seeing my comrades leave on the boats and being stuck behind like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you when Tet of 68 hit, and How much more fighting did you and your boat and your unit have? How much more fighting did you engage in?
Well, once I was left behind in Mito and our patrol section left to go on the LST, mm-hmm. I was out of communication, not knowing what their assignments were, mm-hmm. where they were patrolling. Mm-hmm. All I knew is what was going on in Mito, because that's where I was. And the city was under attack. After a few days, when the major battle subsided and the SEAL were able to keep the compound safe, mm-hmm. I was called in by the lieutenant in charge of the maintenance crew, me and my crewman, and he asked us to go over to the hospital about three blocks west mm-hmm. and give the doctors and the nurses there aid because of the amount of wounded. And so we went over there, and for the next 3 or 4 days, we were orderlies helping the nurses and the doctors, mm-hmm. and they're again feeling completely inept mm-hmm. and unprepared. But we had to help them. There was many hundreds and hundreds of people wounded in the hallways of the hospital, mm-hmm. Some civilians, some military, a lot of civilian people, people who had shrapnel in their legs and arms. Under normal circumstances, when you had time, you'd be able to do an operation, take the shrapnel out, maybe wire the bones back together, and somebody would have a chance of survival. But in this dire situation with all the wounded, the doctor, we were amputating the arms and legs one after the other, and we were there in the operating room helping them. And I couldn't, after the third day, I couldn't deal with that anymore. Mm-hmm. And I actually left and went down to the maintenance facility, and I've always regretted that I didn't stay there to help longer, but I just couldn't deal with it anymore.
Okay. What kind of information, news information, were you receiving throughout your time in Vietnam? You know, what were your news sources?
The main news sources was by word of mouth through our officers to our boat captains, little bits of information, but it was primarily specific to our patrol area. As far as general news about what was going on in the area, our major news source was the Jack Staff newspaper that came out twice a month, and that gave us all the information that what the Navy was doing on coastal patrols, on interdiction programs. Also, it gave a synopsis of all of the River Patrol sections and what activities and firefights and engagements with the enemy that had transpired that month. So it was, and a lot of us had crewmen that we trained with that were in different parts of the country that we knew were in different patrol sections. So we were anxious for any news that we would hear from the newspaper mm-hmm. About those engagements, wondering if some of our friends, you know, were involved in some of those engagements. Mm-hmm. But it was a major source of news, was that newspaper.
Did it cover much of what was going on in the U.S.?
No. The only thing we heard about was little bits and pieces that we did hear on the service radio station. Mm-hmm. But, of course, that was filtered by the military, so I'm sure we weren't getting much about the demonstrations and things that were going on in America at the time. Mm-hmm. A lot of that we hear from new men coming in telling us what was going on in the States.
Do you remember how they described it, how things were in the United States, especially later in your tour, say late 67 and early 68 before Tet?
Before Tet? Yeah. All I knew was little bits and pieces. We'd get some fellows that were coming in saying that they would describe a lot of some protests that were going on, and a lot of college students were being involved with the protesting, and they also mentioned for us to be careful when we go home and not to be too vocal and take off our uniforms as soon as we got home, because we would be harassed by the college students if they knew that we were home from Vietnam. Hmm. And so they were kind of cautioned to be careful where we wore our uniforms when we got home, and mentioning that we were veterans, and that was brought to starkly to reality to me later on, years later, actually, in 70, mm-hmm. 71, when I went back to college. I made the mistake of mentioning that I was a Vietnam vet one time, and the in the student quad and having students surround me in a circle and harass me.
Really?
For allowing myself to be utilized by the government as a tool of their imperial goals or something to that effect.
Hmm.
But it was not a very, it was a very unpleasant experience, and I was very cautious and careful not to admit that I was a veteran after.
Did, you didn't get violent, did it?
I got spat on.
Oh, very nice.
By one woman, a
mm-hmm.
girl.
Mm-hmm.
The college women seemed to be the most vocal and violent. Mm-hmm. There was guys there too, but
mm-hmm.
This my incident. I was surrounded by a couple of two or three guys and about four or five women, and the women students were the worst.
Mm-hmm.
But I was careful and cautious after that, not
yeah.
to say anything.
Now, when during TET and during your last couple of months there in country, the new guys coming in, what kind of information were they bringing, or were they telling you in terms of what was going on at home with regard to TET? Do you remember?
Well, because I was there right at the end of TET,
mm-hmm.
and then after the battle subsided, mm-hmm. I finished my assignment at the hospital. And I finally got taken over to heliport just outside of town, me and one other fellow, and a helicopter came in and picked us up, although there was a bunch of South Vietnamese Army officers that we thought we were going to get bumped, but when they found out we were due to go home, overdue actually, we got held up a couple weeks in TET because of TET. The pilot had us get on the helicopter above the ranked South Vietnamese Army officers and took us home to Saigon. And from the time I left Mito, processed through Saigon and got on the airplane to leave was very quick. It was just a day or so. And in that time, I didn't get to... It was
okay.
A real rushed time.
Yeah.
Also, Tonsonut was under rocket attack.
Mm-hmm.
While we were standing in line to get on the airplane, a rocket hit the building maybe 500 yards down the building
mm-hmm.
on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we are waiting in line still in the building getting shelled. And we were all nervous about even being able to get on the airplane and get out of there. But
mm-hmm.
we finally made it on the airplane and flew out.
Okay.
And much hurrah
on
the airplane. Yep.
Where did you arrive in the United States?
What time was it? That was late February, 1st of March,
mm-hmm.
late February. I flew from there to Japan. It was winter in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Got off the airplane, bought a new camera, got off on the airplane, flew from there to Travis. Travis.
Mm-hmm.
And then flew from Travis down to my hometown in Riverside, California. That's how I got home. As far as information, I did not receive any good current information until I got home and was advised that by my mother at the time that she knew that the Mito was under attack
mm-hmm.
just weeks before and didn't have any word about my survival. And so until I got home, she didn't know I was safe.
Mm. Did you have very much correspondence with your mom or with anybody else back home while you were in Vietnam?
Yeah, we had letters back and forth,
yeah.
you know, on at least either biweekly or weekly basis.
Okay.
My mom did not give me any information about the protests or much what was going on
mm-hmm.
in America, and her letters were fairly short.
Okay. When you arrived back at Riverside and were home, did you notice that much had changed from the time you left to go in the Navy to go to Vietnam and then when you came back?
No, my recollection is, of course, being in South Vietnam on the rivers, it was actually beautiful, that part of the country, and then flying into LAX and seeing the smog was a reminder of the smoggy conditions of Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as how things looked, it didn't look a lot different from when I left. It was really to realize that you could fly from home into a war war zone, be there for a year in those conditions, and then fly home and it be just the way it was when you left was weird.
Mm-hmm. How about the attitudes of people, though, especially attitudes of your friends and neighbors and other family members regarding the war?
I don't recall a lot of discussion about it.
Okay.
If I'd have probably gotten right back into school right then,
mm-hmm.
But actually what happened to me is I still had a couple more months active duty.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew home. I was home for a month. I don't recall. I remember going and visiting my uncle and aunt in San Diego and a few other relatives. Not remember too much being discussed about the war, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then going back to San Diego and being assigned to a light missile cruiser for a month and then a destroyer and then eventually getting mustered out and then going home. And then after I got home, I went to work for a month or two at my old job, and then I left to be a missionary for the LDS Church for 2 years. So I was I shifted environments quite
mm-hmm.
abruptly.
Mm-hmm.
And now the next 2 years in Chicago area or Illinois area, my church assignment was to dialogue and teach church principles and lessons. And so I talk about a contrast in
mm-hmm.
activities.
Mm-hmm.
And I did come in contact on some of my assignments in the next 2 years. For the church, I did get into some college areas. I was stationed or assigned to Peoria at one time at Bradley University and came into contact with some students in Bradley, and they were open-minded and invited us in, and we had some good dialogues and discussions, and it came out that I was a Vietnam veteran, and they were not too... They were very decent in their, I don't know, maybe it was just happened to be the students that we were talking to, those particular ones, but
mm-hmm.
they didn't seem to be too anti-war or they didn't give me a hard time. It was later on when I went back to college that I had that bad incident
mm-hmm.
of being verbally abused, but that time it wasn't. There again, I was in a different environment, teaching church lessons and church people interested in learning about the church, teaching them church history and church information. So, completely a contrast in environments. Yeah, I think what I did is put my whole self into that activity and pushed my Vietnam experience back. And kind of buried it to some extent.
Now, why do you think you did that? Why did you bury, I guess, mentally, psychologically, your Vietnam War experience at first?
Well, when we worked with the SEALs, sometimes there was some things that happened with prisoners
mm-hmm.
that I didn't want to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience with the wounded children and some of the things that happened there.
Right. You want to take a break?
Yeah.
Okay. This will end CD number 1 of the interview with Steve Summerall on the 28th of August.